Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the contributors to strategypage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of strategypage.com, your host. We'll be talking to Jim Dunnigan, well-known military analyst, author, and editor of strategypage.com. Welcome, Jim. Thought today that we could talk a little bit about Japan. Last couple of weeks, you wrote an article, or I guess it was actually a few weeks ago, just before Hiroshima anniversary, you wrote an article about Japan's view of World War II and how they were rewriting history, and we got a lot of response on that. This has actually been something that's been going on for quite a while, hasn't it?
Yes. This is a phenomenon that began as the war ended. As I pointed out in the article, several years after the war, when the United States got around to decrypting the diplomatic messages radioed to Japanese embassies after they surrendered, this was thought to be of no immediate, interest, but, they eventually got around to it. They found one message which basically told all of the ambassadors and their staffs to try and play up the nuclear bombs and how the Japanese are victims, and it wasn't our fault, et cetera, et cetera. So, they had the drill down from day one, as soon as the war ended. They went into victim mode. Actually, they were in victim mode even before the war and during the war. They always had a very different outlook on the war. But what's most interesting about Japan today, which is what we have to be mostly concerned about, is they're disappearing. The latest demographic forecasts have the population of Japan declining 25% in the next 40 years. Many other countries are declining, but Japan is right at the top of the list. They just recently, this last quarter, became the third largest economy on the planet. They used to be second for a long time. So Japan, literally, is fading away.
And they have the problem of where Europe, the Caucasian population is fading away. They have the influx of Muslims and Eastern Europeans and like that, whereas Japan does not allow any immigration at all, correct?
They do allow some immigration. They even have some illegal migrants. There is a fringe of society in Japan, but they're very hostile to it, and it's a very controlled society, and they don't allow any, illegal migrants to really put down roots. So they are not saving themselves by allowing a lot of immigration. They have so far been unsuccessful to get the women to agree to have more kids. They can certainly afford it. I mean, they're the wealthiest nation in that neighborhood. Although they're number three in GDP, they have the average Japanese has 10 times the income as the average Chinese. So they're doing very well economically, not so well, reproducing themselves. But in the meantime, they're also the second most powerful military power in that part of the world. The Russian forces out there are pretty thin on the ground. China, while larger in terms of troops and equipment holdings, is not up to the quality of the Japanese. Although the Japanese haven't really fought a war since World War II, American service people I speak to who have worked with the Japanese come away impressed. They train hard. They seem very professional. On training exercises, they always equip themselves well. They're dependable, et cetera, et cetera. And, the average, the general feeling is that if there were a war, they'd go right back into kamikaze mode. I mean, not suicidal, but they would do what has to be done. And they're mostly concerned about China these days. North Korea is a concern because the North Korean is run by maniacs. And they have ballistic missiles that can reach Japan, and they have primitive, nuclear weapons. And the North Koreans talk about, hating Japan, which all Koreans do because of the occupation in the first 40 years in early in the 20th century. But even before that, there was a lot of animosity between Japanese and Koreans. And animosities mean a lot more in East Asia than they do in most other parts of the world. But the Japanese aren't really concerned about that because the actual military power the Koreans can project is really not that impressive. In fact, recently the North Koreans tried to shake down Japan for more reparations for, you know, the occupation from 1905 to 1945, and the Japanese just ignore them. So, I mean, you know, the Japanese and North Koreans understand the true military, you know, balance between the two nations, but the Japanese have to pay attention to the fact that the North Koreans are, you know, a little whack. And they do have ballistic missiles, which is one reason why Japan now has Aegis-equipped warships that have the anti-missile missile system aboard. So they have some way to defend themselves, and they're buying other, you know, anti-missile systems. The fact of the matter is that the one armed force in that part of East Asia, not counting Australia, which is Southeast Asia, Japan has by far the most modern and the most high-tech military. South Koreans are catching up, but right now it's Japan. And when Americans' military forces train with the Japanese, they always feel like they're operating with a peer, somebody who's got, you know, gadgets, you know, up to our standards, as it were, and training up to our standards as well. And that's what bothers the Chinese so much, that they feel that if they did get into a fight with the Japanese, they might come out as poorly as they have in all previous, you know, run-ins.
Now, we ran an article, I think it's a couple of years ago now, about the Japanese were starting to develop carrier capabilities again.
Yes. That was about 3 years ago. The destroyers, the large destroyers, they look just like aircraft carriers, but they basically are small, you know, very large aircraft, you know, very small aircraft carriers, and or very large destroyers, as the Japanese would describe. Yeah, they can carry half a dozen or so medium, you know, size helicopters or, you know, a vertical takeoff jet. But no, they're mostly built for anti-submarine helicopters. The Japanese are mostly concerned with the Chinese, you know, 60 or so submarines. Now, most of those submarines are trash, but since Japan is dependent upon imports and imports of food and a lot of other goods and exports of a lot of manufactured goods, they are very reliant on keeping their sea, access to the sea open. So they have spent a lot of time working on anti-submarine warfare. And as we know from the history of anti-submarine warfare, the submarines always have the edge. Every time, I mean, there's been two major wars, World War I and World War II, where in the beginning everybody was saying, oh, those submarines, they're piles of crap. Well, mostly, especially in World War I, by the time World War II came along, they realized, ooh, these things can get, you know, nasty. But there hasn't been a anti-submarine campaign since World War II. We're talking going on 70 years now. And there's a whole new generation of weapons. And as we reported in Strategy Page over the last decade, the U.S. Navy has been doing a lot of work, as it were, training exercises with diesel electric submarines. Either they leased one from Sweden for a couple of years, and then they deal with the Australians whenever the Australian submarines are working, and have discovered that these diesel electric submarines can be very formidable. Now, what the Navy has not said, and actually I haven't reported much. We're very careful about OPSEC, you know, operational security, and letting the cat out of the bag. But I've been seeing more about this lately. The Navy has developed some new techniques, which of course they want to keep secret, because if the potential enemy knows about these new anti-submarine or submarine detection techniques, obviously they can do things to defeat them. But they have developed a lot of new stuff. One of them we did report, I think just today, which is not deployed yet, but it gives people an idea of what's coming down the pike, and that's continuous sonar. It's a low-level sonar to deflect the animal rights lawyers who are always suing the Navy for disturbing the calm of the undersea creatures with their sonar. But this is a low-level, but continuous sonar, like radar, it's going all the time. And this enables you to basically avoid having a submarine sneak up on you, which submarines try to do. The Navy has various other technologies, which they're not talking about, and I won't either, that give that, that presence, that persistent presence, of anti-submarine, warning. Which is critical. And we saw an example of that earlier this year with the North Korean submarine sinking the South Korean Corvette. They just released the entire report on that. A lot of the conspiracy theorists and desperate journalists had been, you know, running with a story that it wasn't a torpedo. It was they ran aground. They did anything but a torpedo because that's a hot story. It's a conspiracy theory. Well, the South Korean scientists said, well, I guess we better release the whole report, even if it might give away some, you know, information about how we go about these things or whatever. Which, as we pointed out, immediately after, you know, the Cheonan went down, he says, you know, they can pull that sucker up. It wasn't in deep water. We knew that from the beginning. And they'll raise it just like an airplane, you know, crash, and they'll put it back together. And there have been pictures of that. They reassembled it, you know, in a large dry dock, large building. And it was obvious. I guess once you put it back together, you take one look at it. And they brought in about 40 or 50 foreign, you know, naval experts, you know, the naval architects and what have you, people who know how to look at a ship or how ships are built and how to look at one that's been damaged and say, oh, yeah, that's a this, that's a that. It ran up on a sandbar. Oh, no, it hit rocks. It went over a naval mine. Oh, that's a torpedo. Because all these forms of fatal damage for a ship make a distinctive, you know, imprint on the ship, as it were. In this case, they blew it in half. But, you know, you can see it's an external explosion. All the metal is bending inward. And, of course, the South Koreans found fragments of North Korean torpedo, which a lot of people, the conspiracy theorists, oh, no, they made that up, et cetera, but no. It walks like a duck, it talks like a duck, and it blows up like a torpedo. It's a torpedo. So this was a wake-up call to all maritime nations that the North Koreans with their rinky-dink, you know, little miniature submarines, and we've talked about them several times. These are things in which, you know, can stay out maybe a day or two, can carry, you know, maybe two torpedoes, have a crew of maybe half a dozen or more, a dozen guys. But running on batteries, they're very hard to detect, and they can sneak up on, you know, they were just looking for a South Korean ship. And that South Koreans, one of the criticisms the Commission of Inquiry made was that the Cheonan ran on a fairly predictable route, which is always a big mistake if you're so close to a bunch of wackos like the North Koreans. Anyway, this has happened again and again in the past, and it happened again. The North Koreans said, all right, we're going to get these guys. It was all revenge for a naval battle last year where South Koreans, you know, quickly dispatched an older and less well-equipped North Korean gunboat. And there were several other embarrassing incidents. But this was an example of what can happen to you if you don't have some way of detecting a submarine in the neighborhood. And this is all too common a situation because right now the only way you get an alert to turn on your sonar and offend all the you know, the lovers of undersea creatures with sensitive hearing is to have, you know, the CIA or somebody else say, hey, you know, North Koreans are putting all their submarines to sea and what have you. You better be on the alert, get your anti-submarine helicopters out there, and, you know, be warned. In most of the time, or a lot of the time, in situations like the Cheonan, you're not going to get any warning. I mean, what's to stop the North Koreans from sending out a couple of their boats to get close to one of our aircraft carriers that are out there right now doing anti-submarine exercises? How ironic would that be?
Right.
It can happen, especially if you're crazy and you've got sailors who are suicidal.
Yeah. Now,
and all the terrorists in the world are not, you know, Muslims.
Right. Now, one of the things that the Japanese are doing
and while they've been doing it for quite some time, is they've been trying to make sure that they have their own capabilities for weapons procurement and not having to worry about going outside of Japan to get stuff. But most recently with their aircraft, they've been trying to develop high-performance aircraft, correct?
Yes, they have built, by licensing some technology from the United States, an improved F-16. And they have a ground attack aircraft, which they're building more of. It's not an A-10, but, you know, it's sort of like an F-16 optimized for ground attack. Their problem with their defense manufacturing, especially aircraft, is that it's done all inside Japan, and it's very expensive. In other words, it's a make-work program. Their constitution still prohibits them from exporting weapons, and they're trying to change that. They've been debating that for years. But they need the business, and they're doing some great work. But the one thing that'll change if they start exporting weapons is all of a sudden the companies that manufacture weapons are going to have to get a whole lot more efficient, because they can't export weapons at what it's costing them now. So a lot [S2] Right. [S1] Of feather bedding, a lot of, you know, make work, so to speak, is going to go out the window. And everybody understands that. They're going to have to be competitive price-wise. But it's understood that, you know, they'll be competitive quality-wise, which is one reason why the United States has sort of discouraged that. I mean, we can't stop them, but we can say, gee, we're not really, you know, keen on seeing you change your constitution, you warmongers, you. But, you know, World War II is fading and fading and fading. And you really can't use that argument anymore, because it's a different generation. Or several generations, you know, since. Although there is some concern. I work with Japanese on a regular basis, and I know one of the guys I'm on good terms with. He says it quite bluntly. He speaks good English. He says, you know, the grandchildren of the World War II veterans have forgotten. In other words, they've learned nothing. They're very jingoistic. They're not talking about invading China again. I mean, Chinese having nuclear weapons does have an impact on people's attitudes. But they're all for building up the military. And right. Building nuclear weapons. Now, that's something that's taboo to talk about in Japan, although it occasionally gets into the media, although it rarely gets into translated into the American media. In fact, I've checked a couple of times, and a friend of mine gave me a heads up on stories in the Japanese media about, you know, Japan should build nuclear weapons for its security. And I went and checked the English language websites. And it wasn't there. But Japanese do that. They will, like everybody, like a lot of countries do, a lot of nations do, they will say one thing to each other and something else to the foreigners.
Right.
The Arabs are famous for that. The Russians always did that. And most other countries will to a certain extent. Some things we can talk about amongst ourselves, but we don't want to tell the foreigners. But they could, within a year, be a nuclear power.
And that's because they have nuclear reactors and the technology.
They're very dependent because they haven't got much in the way of natural, except coal, which is dirty, and they haven't got a lot of that anymore. Yes, they use nuclear power for electricity generation much more than any other nation. And they make plutonium. They have breeder reactors to make more fuel. That's why they have the plutonium. But they, in fact, they were a major purchaser of the plutonium from Russian and American warheads, which were dismantled and demilitarized, as it were. It's all making electricity for the Japanese. But they have all the technology they need to create nuclear weapons. And the understanding with the Chinese is, if the Chinese don't get too rambunctious, and the Chinese have, you know, that then Japan won't go nuclear. And the Chinese have basically obeyed that understanding. There was a time, about 5 years ago, when there were the Chinese on the internet started to get very, rambunctious about, some Japanese big shot was visiting Japan, or there was an anniversary of VJ Day, whatever. The anniversary of one of the many atrocities the Japanese committed in China during World War II. And the internet agitation started to translate into, mobs forming before the Japanese embassy. Well, the Japanese said, they said, well, this is not right, very politely. And the Chinese turned around and had the riot police all over the place. And those demonstrations went away real quick. And apparently the word was put out, as long as, the Japanese don't have nuclear weapons, we don't insult them, violently or too enthusiastically. So there is that understanding. But at the same time, the Chinese, as we've reported in Strategy Page, have been more and more aggressive in sending their electronic monitoring ships right up to the edge of the Japanese waters, and having Chinese submarines exercising openly, right off Japan, again, in international waters, but making the point that, hey, we can get our submarines out here. Japan feels threatened.
Right. Now, the U.S. has been slowly drawing down its forces in Japan, and what, Okinawa is supposed to be completely shut down here in the future?
Well, ultimately, right now, we've only agreed to move a lot of the activity to Guam. That is more local politics than military reality. Okinawa doesn't feel part of Japan, and Japan doesn't feel like Okinawans are really Japanese. I mean, they're very blunt about that. Okinawa has druthers that would be an independent country, but the Japanese won't allow that. And the United States and other countries in the area are not inclined to encourage the Okinawans. So that is very much on the back burner, in independent Okinawa. But the Okinawans love to embarrass Tokyo, let's put it that way. Although the Okinawans have a lot of complaints about the Americans provide a lot of jobs. As the American forces leave Okinawa, a lot of Okinawans are going to be unemployed. You know how it is with islands, whether
right.
it's Hawaii or Puerto Rico. They don't have the resources to become self-sustaining, to have a vibrant economy. They depend on one thing or another. And Okinawa has a certain amount of tourism, but not enough to really support the population in the manner to which they've become accustomed. They've basically been doing very well since the war. Before that, they were a very poor, island. Since the economic growth in the 60s and 70s in Japan spread to Okinawa, a lot of it was really dependent upon the jobs that the Americans gave. You have a lot of Okinawans, especially the ones who work on those bases, are very acutely aware of that, but the majority of Okinawans don't work, are not dependent upon jobs on the bases, and they tend to get out there and enthusiastically demonstrate against the American presence. But what they're really demonstrating against is American and Japanese, military occupation.
Right.
So once we're gone, the Japanese don't like that either, but they know then the Okinawans are just going to complain about the Japanese occupation. But that's the trend. Long term, we'll be out of there. I think we'll always have some presence there, air base rights or what have you.
Right.
Because if there is a war out there, we will, and the Japanese will want us, to be operating, aircraft, from bases in Okinawa. But as far as basing, Marine Division, we can do that from Guam, which is an American territory, and the Guamese, they understand exactly what's going on. We are transferring jobs from Okinawa to Guam, and the Guamians are very happy with that.
Right.
A lot of Guamians are veterans and what have you, and they know they'd be at the top of the list with veterans' preference and getting a job on the new American bases, so they're more than happy to have the business.
And the island is not going to capsize like one congressman was afraid of because of all the money.
No. No. And like I say, like all the islands in the Pacific, they need the work. They need the business.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, there's not much there. I mean, the Chinese came in with sweatshops, which was popular up to a point, but they were sweatshops. But civil service jobs on a military base, that's in a whole different category.
Yeah. The interesting thing is Guam is the honeymoon destination for the wealthy Japanese.
And yes, and that's sort of a traditional thing because I think for several reasons, some of them having to do with geography and the attitudes of the Guam is not a part of Japan as Okinawa is.
Right.
And there's always been a bit of tension between the people in Okinawa and the Japanese.
Yeah.
Having to do with Japan conquering the Kingdom of Okinawa a century or so after that, how many hundred years ago it was. Okinawans have never forgotten. But Guam is an exotic. It's part of America.
Right.
And it's relatively close. So you can save a few yen and get that foreign,
well,
honeymoon. And, of course, the whole tourism business in Guam is set up to deliver the fantasy, you're looking for.
Yeah.
I mean, every island out there has beaches.
Right.
And I don't think that the additional American, military aircraft is going to disturb the honeymooners any more than all those 747s flying in and out are.
No. Now, obviously, we'll keep our listening posts up north, and there'll be our presence just won't be as large.
It'll be quieter. I mean, the main thing that aggravates the Okinawans that they can riot against is the noise of all the aircraft and all those Marines who do cause. I mean, they bring a lot of business. A lot of Okinawans are going to be out of business, but they are a minority of the population. But every time a Marine, gets, rapes somebody or beats up a cab driver or whatever, there's actually a lower crime rate among the Marines on Okinawa than there is in Japan in general. But that doesn't fly when you're talking about, just having an excuse to stick it to the Japanese. Any crime will do. But that'll all go away. And the only people who will be left will be geeks and, Air Force personnel, which are basically geeks.
Right. Geeks in uniform.
Right. Exactly.
The last thing to talk about is Japan has entered the space race over the last decade or so, and I guess that will continue with...
Yeah, they've done it as a business. I mean, the Chinese are talking about putting somebody on the moon and, all this other nationalistic, expensive stuff. But for the Japanese, it's strictly a business. They're satellite launching. They build satellites. They launch satellites. And they could probably do it cheaper by many other Western countries do, sending their satellites to China to be launched on those big old kerosene burners. But they simply want to stay in the technology race, which is why they're doing it, because that's how they've made their bones, that made their money. That's their big money maker in the last few decades is technology. They are, maintaining that capability. And, a whole array of high tech. That's what scares the Chinese. They realize that the Japanese are innovators, superb engineers. And they are doing what the Chinese cannot do yet.
Right. Well,
by the time the Chinese can do it, there won't be any Japanese left. They'll have basically disappeared because they wouldn't reproduce.
I guess one of the things that I've read quite a bit about in Japan because of their shrinking demographic is that they've developed robotics to the point, well, actually, one of the big trends is they want to develop robotics to take care of all the old
people. The elderly, yes.
Right.
Yeah, the only thing, that's ultimately all that'll be left of Japan will be Japanese-speaking robots.
Right, yeah. But has that,
Cylons.
I guess, what of that robotics technology has entered into their military?
They are doing that. They have a very high degree of automation throughout their military. What's most impressive is how they use that robotic technology in weapons manufacturing. That is basically how they expect to be a competitive manufacturer of high-tech weapons, because they have pioneered the use of manufacturing automation and robotics. So they are definitely going to be a player. They are probably also going to be one of the players in the robotic combat aircraft. Now they haven't developed anything yet, but this is another reason why they have to basically change their constitution so they can export weapons again, because they could become a major exporter of robotic fighter bombers and fighters. And for example, the U.S. Navy just came out. The commander of the U.S. Navy just came out just this week and said he wants stealthy robotic attack aircraft on American aircraft carriers within 8 years. Now, we've been reporting this all along, and the last report I think we did, we said the Navy wants it within a decade, and they just bailed on 8 years before we narrowed down to 6-5, whatever. They are, the Navy is very close. In the next year or so, they're going to be having a UAV, making an automatic landing on a carrier. Takeoffs are easy. You know, landings are hard on carriers.
Right.
And they've already done air-to-air refueling. I mean, we're way down the road as far as robotic aircraft. But the Japanese also have that robotics technology. In many ways, they are ahead of us.
Right, especially indeed, in the artificial intelligence area.
Exactly. And indeed, for all I know, I haven't got the facts on this, but the American combat UAVs may indeed have Japanese technology already. We have a lot of, you know, trade deals with the technology, cross-use licenses and things like that. But they are definitely the people to go to if you want, you know, reliable, you know, fail-safe software for your critical robotic needs. And there ain't nothing more critical than a 10-ton, you know, robotic aircraft landing on an aircraft carrier.
Well, it looks like Japan's going to remain a power out there in the Northern Pacific and hopefully
keep... As long as there's some of them, you know, still being
alive.
And after they're gone, there'll be Japanese combat robots still roaming around. So we better start thinking about how we're going to deal with that.
Right. All right. Thanks, Jim, and we'll talk to you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.